this week. The NASDAQ briefly topped that 5,000 level for the first time in 15 years since the dot-com days. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek here. Thanks for tuning back with us for another big show. Well, just like the weather, with blizzards one day and summer-like temperatures the next, volatility returned to the markets this week. Joining me to help make sense of all the price gyrations, Louise Yamada makes her debut appearance on the show. We're honored to have her here. She's a highly respected market maven who correctly predicted this bull market years in advance. Unlike the stock market price top of the year 2000, this time she says valuations are more reasonable and the market is behaving a bit more orderly. However, several laggard sectors suggest that we could see at least a 5% pullback, providing a pause which refreshes the market for higher prices. And the greenback bull run may only be in its infancy. Odds favor a multi-year advance. Then Dr. Mark Faber returns to the show after a three-year hiatus from his Thai home office. He says China has the most trading partners of any nation, and that the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, may have accumulated significantly more gold than expected in anticipation of a gold-backed yuan. So while their currency is eroded, the gold stockpile increases in value, and he's been unnerved by all the share buyback announcements, pointing to historical records which show that that tends to coincide with market peaks. He prefers emerging market equities instead, expecting them to outperform U.S. shares. And he suggests everybody diversify their portfolios, the only free lunch out there, if you will. But he parks 25% of that in the precious metals. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the markets this week. As of Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the dollar rally seemed to cap gold prices, which were off less than $50, about 4% for the week, ending at $1,164, below $1,200. Silver dropped about 77 cents, 4.5%, finishing at $1,581. The XEU Gold and Silver Equities Index fell 9 points, 12%, ending at $67. West Texas Intermediate crude finished near the break-even point, off 8 cents at $49.61 per barrel. Well, the top story moving the markets on Friday, a Labor Department report indicated solid jobs growth. So what's wrong with that, right? Solid job sounds like a plus for the markets. Investors took the news to indicate that the Fed was much more likely to raise rates now that things look, well, more sanguine. U.S. employers added 295,000 jobs in February, and the unemployment rate fell to the lowest point in about 7 years, down 0.2% to 5.5%. Wouldn't Ben Bernanke have loved that number? The general consensus was that Fed governors would hold rates steady until next year, but now, with all of this economic growth, the FOMC seems to have wiggle room, and the likelihood of a rate hike is even higher, the first since the year 2006, making investors very nervous. Last week, Fed Chair Janet Yellen noted that the timing of the rate hike would be based on economic data. The dollar blasted to an 11-year high, as forecasted here in this report over the past several weeks, ahead of the U.S. jobs data that could provide hints about timing of a rate increase. The U.S. currency gained momentum on strong domestic economic numbers. Global investors are pre-positioning themselves ahead of perceived rate hikes. Higher rates makes the U.S. dollar much more attractive relative to global alternatives. Precious metals bottom line. As mentioned in the last report, the dollar rally is keeping up professional investors at night. They see the writing on the wall. A sea change is here in the markets. The currency Titanic has changed course and sliced through years of resistance levels as though they weren't even there. It appears that the Fed will have ample room to make a token rate hike as soon as this summer. This will likely provide a capitulation moment for investors interested in bargain prices. Moving on to the Wall Street report, cloudy skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors bought the rumor of economic strength, but then sold the fact. On Friday, the Dow Jones Industrials average finished lower by 275 points, ending at 17,856. The S&P 500 ended at 20,000. 71 off 33 points, down 1.5%. And after briefly topping the infamous 5,000 level this week, the Nasdaq fell 36 points, ending at 49.27. U.S. stocks dropped sharply Friday amid the better-than-expected U.S. payrolls report and hints of an upcoming rate hike made investors skittish. A strong dollar is emblematic of higher rates, which lowers the appeal of dividends and earnings. Utilities companies and sectors with high dividend yields, such as REITs, were hard hit on Friday as investors booked profits. Shares of energy companies also sagged about 1.5%. Yet, despite the selling on Friday, shares of Apple rose to $127 on news that the stock would become one of the 30 Dow components, replacing AT&T, which fell sharply in the Dow Jones average. Bank of America shares also rose 1.5% after positive stress test results, and Foot Locker blasted higher by 4% after the sportswear retailer posted better than expected earnings. Bottom line on Wall Street. Our favorite seven indicator sentiment index helped last week to predict this sell-off we saw, and it's still, though, showing signs of greed. Typically, when you have a sharp sell-off in the markets, people lose their greediness and tend to lean towards fearfulness. We're not saying that. If a bottom were in place, fear would just be intense. We see few signs of this, which increases the likelihood of further volatility in the coming weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Louise Yamada and Dr. Mark Faber. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Today, our featured guest, Louise Yamada, who makes her debut appearance on GoldSeek.com radio. She formed the independent research company Louise Yamada Technical Research Advisors and is a well-known and widely respected market technician, author, who appears regularly as a commentator on CNBC. Good morning and welcome to GoldSeek.com radio, Louise Yamada.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, we're glad to have you with us, and I wonder if we could begin the dialogue today with your technical view on the U.S. equities market. This week, the Nasdaq apparently topped that 5,000 benchmark, a number not seen since, I guess, the year 2000 dot-com bubble peak. Do you see signs of frothiness here, or could this be maybe the early stages of the next 20-year equities bonanza?
You mean for the NASDAQ itself? I think this time the NASDAQ has progressed quite nicely. All the way back to 2000, the NASDAQ really had an incredible collapse, came all the way back practically to 1,000 from 5,000, and then had a 13-year sideways consolidation. And the old saying is, the bigger the top, the bigger the drop, and the bigger the drop, the longer the need for repair. So when NASDAQ really broke out through 3,000 in 2012, we were suggesting that we had on our hands perhaps the beginning of a new bull market for the NASDAQ itself. And, of course, it's primarily made up of technology stocks. So as we approach 5,000 this time, there's been a little bit of a back off. But when price seems to move to these round numbers and historical levels, there's a psychology that takes time before you can get through, and I think you may get a little bit of hesitation going on over the next period of weeks, perhaps, before it can actually push through to a new high. But you don't have the outrageous valuations today that you had back in 2000. I mean, the stocks that are included now and are functioning as viable companies don't have 130 PEs. They have normal PEs, and some of them, like a Microsoft or an Intel today, are paying dividends. So it's perhaps a healthier situation.
I really like your comments regarding the way that the NASDAQ has progressed, this gradual progression. I'm sure you recall, I was there as well, 1999. It seemed like the market maybe doubled or even trebled in just a year or two. And we're not quite seeing that overenthusiasm just yet. But do you expect, though, that perhaps the speculation will come back into these markets?
I don't see it at the moment. I think that we have to recognize that a lot of the market that has progressed since 2009 has been because of the Federal Reserve has given so much liquidity. And the old saying, don't fight the Fed, as long as that liquidity is there, the markets have been able to rise. You're not getting much in the way of yield from, you know, Treasury, so it's forcing people to go into something that could be considered a little bit more risky, and certainly is.
You mentioned liquidity, an important component of many of these rallies. Of course, maybe we don't have too much of a track record to go by. I mean, just the previous 1980s and 90s bull market, but it seemed to be an important factor. Listening to Dr. Yellen and many of the other folks, Fed officials and governors last week, there seems to be some inconsistency among the comments there. There's some doves and some hawks. Do you think that they will pull the trigger on higher rates, or has that really been discounted by the market so far?
Well, you could argue that it's already been discounted. Usually an initial interest rate rise doesn't rattle the markets that much. It's not till you get to the second, or even more importantly, the third, that the markets get rattled. But on the other hand, one economic comment that I've read, I mean, I'm a technician, but nevertheless, you see what's being written, is that this will be the first time, if they raise it, that it will happen so far or so many years into the economic recovery. But it's been a weak economic recovery. And, of course, one of the things that we actually wrote about in the mid-90s was looking for inflation in all the wrong places. We have a capital goods environment in this country that's a lot less than it used to be in the 70s, when it was sort of rust belt in terms of machinery and that sort of thing. And now we're much more technologically oriented. And the technology itself, whether it's robots or making an office much more efficient, doesn't create the kind of inflation that occurred when you had something being produced and then it had that much inventory, and the more inventory there was, the less the price came down, or less inventory, the prices went up, that kind of inflationary pressure. Now the inflationary pressures, to my mind, are in consumer essentials like food and education and health care. And I'm not sure that that's being registered as a rise in inflation, but anybody who goes marketing knows perfectly well that there's inflation out there big time.
Very well said. And I think it's an interesting perspective you offer there with regard to the sea change that we've seen in our manufacturing sector, how technology and robotics have taken the forefront, and how that doesn't seem to lead to the excessive inventories. And plus, we have just-in-time processes today. Well, you know, in a recent commentary, you outlined the Dow-to-gold ratio. It's very interesting. A rising line tends to coincide with equities outperformance, and then when the trend is declining, gold tends to outperform. Now, since the 2011 commodities peak, equities have clearly enjoyed higher highs. And do you expect the trend with equities, you know, regularly making new highs relative to commodities and precious metals? Do you think that theme will persist here for some time?
I think it's just initiated a shift in favor of equities versus gold. And these are long shifts. The peaks in the ratio happened in 1929, 1968, 2000. I think that the decline that we've seen in gold over the past several years has certainly coincided with a continuation of the lift in equities, particularly the breakout in 2013 to a new all-time high in terms of the S&P and the Dow, suggests to us that gold is probably not finished with its bear market, doesn't necessarily have to go incredibly lower. But that any rallies that may occur in gold are going to be what we call contra-trend rallies, which are rallies in the opposite direction from the major trend, and they will probably coincide with any decline that we get as a contra-trend pullback in the equity market, which we still think is in a structural bull market, which initiated, you could say, 2009, but it was really not proven until we moved out to a new high in 2013. So, yes, there will be interim moves, but I would suggest that gold probably will not go back to the 250 level where it was in 1999 or 2000, where it created its last basing. But it could settle somewhere around 1,100 or 1,000 or even 800 if it were to go there and start to stabilize at those levels. Maybe it'll stabilize at current levels. I'm a little skeptical. I think it might go lower. But if we get a correction in the equity market, you're bound to get a rally in gold, but it may not indicate that the bull market has reinitiated or is extending itself. It would just be a rally in an ongoing bear market from a technical perspective.
I share your sentiments here, and it's not easy for a lifelong gold bull to agree with it. But, you know, it's important that we accept the fact, the trend and the market dynamics. For many of our listeners with long-term perspectives, it could represent an excellent opportunity to increase their portfolio exposure to that wonderful insurance policy we call gold and silver. So I wanted to move on, though. You know, sometimes these established correlations that we find in the markets, they don't always hold. For instance, the U.S. dollar and gold tend to be negatively correlated. We've had this U.S. dollar rally, a stealth bull market, you might call it, in the last 9 months amid the sovereign debt issues in Europe and Greece and the Eurozone, capital fleeing that region in favor of our reserve currency. Do you expect the U.S. greenback to remain strong? And if so, what kind of impact could that have on the markets?
That's a very interesting question, which we've looked into. It's been a very impressive breakout. You've seen the price of the dollar exceed the 2009-2010 level, and now you've even seen it exceed the 2005 level. So you basically have almost a 10-year base, and here's the rest of the corollary that we talked about. Bigger the top, the bigger the drop. The bigger the base, the higher in space. And we have this 10-year base, as we had a 12-year base with the NASDAQ, and here in the dollar, I think the size of the base implies that it could go higher. We look back in history, and the last time that we had a very strong dollar corresponding to an equity bull market was from 1995 up to about 2002. So we could have a period of years ahead of us where the market continues to climb along with the dollar, and we'll have to evaluate, what happens in between. If we're not correct, we'll pick it up somehow in the reversal in price. But there is that precedent, which is very interesting, and that was a period where technology was favored. And we are in another period where technology is favored. Technology and healthcare have really, until very recently, been the only things that have carried the market. So it has looked thin, which continues to suggest it may be due for some corrective trend once again. We've seen some of the consumer discretionary come to the fore, but it's been very selective. So that leaves us a little bit concerned about whether we're going to have another 5 or 6% pullback here. It's very difficult to pin the exact pullbacks, and with the Fed being comfortably easing all this time, everybody tends to buy the dips. We'll continue to evaluate it, and stock by stock is what's important. You watch your support levels, and if a stock breaks a support level or reverses the uptrend, you tend to take some off the table to protect your capital.
Keeping with the theme here that you've outlined, we have also seen the energy sector come under considerable pressure, and that's a big component of the S&P 500, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, and the interesting thing is that we track all of the sectors, and we track it with a relative performance to the S&P 500 because that's what the portfolio managers need. They need to outperform. We don't call up Mrs. Smith and say, I've got this great stock for you. It's going to underperform next year. And that's what we saw starting to come into the energy profile in late 2013 and early 2014. The relative strength for the energy versus the S&P was declining and broke a 6-year support. Well, obviously, from a technical perspective, the shorter a support break, the less important it is. But 6 years is very significant, which suggested to us that there was something out there that was not going to be favorable to the energy and energy stocks. And over time, of course, we were proven correct. And the important thing there is by identifying that underperformance trend, it keeps people away from the stocks that are going to damage those stocks that they hold that are outperforming.
Here on the show, we always appreciate those that are technically minded, and because we want for investors to get their minds wrapped around the idea that we really can't outthink the market. There's a lot of sharp folks out there, and we're competing with millions of bright minds. Sometimes you just have to go with the flow and accept the trends and the technical breakdowns and breakouts. Do you have any comments? What's led you to embrace the technical side of the market as opposed to the fundamentals?
Well, because the principle of technical analysis is that it's a study of the supply and demand in the marketplace. An uptrend, for instance, is defined by higher highs, followed by higher lows, followed by higher highs. And the definition of a downtrend is lower lows, followed by lower highs. And the principle is that what you're seeing on a higher low is demand coming into place before price can break down to the low that it saw previously. Similarly, when a support is broken, the implication is that somebody out there smarter than you or I has perceived something about the company that is allowing them to take less, accept less to get out of the stock. And that puts in place a first lower low. And then the rally is an opportunity to get out again, and then it'll go perhaps to a new low. Those are some of the indicators that show that supply is coming into the marketplace or into an individual stock, and that's what we keep an eye on. I will say, just to ease the minds of listeners, is that it's becoming very difficult, even for professionals. I think Jack Bogle's from Vanguard the other day said that 99% of what's going on in the equity market is trading, speculative trading, and only 1% is investment. So what we've been seeing, which has been frustrating to us as professionals, is that you get a stock that breaks out and then it turns right around and it breaks down, or vice versa. It'll break down and then it turns around and starts to go up again. And of course, if you've protected yourself and gotten out when it broke down, you can always get in again when it goes up. It's just that these moves have been happening so quickly that it's been very frustrating, even for the professionals.
As this very interesting discussion wraps up, would you please outline any other technical developments that your work and your colleagues have uncovered that maybe we haven't discussed today?
Covered pretty much everything. I think that currently there might be a little weakness here in the market, which we shared with clients as the month became new, unfolded, I should say. But overall, until we start to see major topping formations the way we saw in 2000 and started getting people out before that decline, and the way we saw in 2007 when financials actually, interestingly, Chris, broke a six-year relative strength support. That was another major call that we had that got people out of financials before the incredible breakdown. Had no idea what was in the works or what was going on, but people were selling and the underperformance was in place. So we don't have any of those major tops yet in the markets themselves. It's a question of watching your individual stocks, and one by one, as they begin to deteriorate, you will have, you know, the eventual formation of a top in the market. We have had some concerns in the sense that we haven't seen as many new highs as this market continues to climb.
I wonder if you would please tell folks more about the services that you provide at Luis Yamada Technical Research Advisors and perhaps any contact information you'd like to make available.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well, we have a website. You can just Google my name, Luis Yamada. There's a little contact us button. We have an institutional report for money managers and mutual funds, and we have an individual report for individual investors and brokers or financial consultants, which is available on request, and we'll send a sample and details.
Very good. Well, Luis Yamada, we want to thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule. Please return soon.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Good evening. Dr. Faber.
Yes, good morning to you.
Wanted to talk to you today about an interesting comment that China may have much more bullion, gold bullion, in their reserves than originally thought. Several thousand tons. They might be preparing for a fully convertible currency. Just last week, there was some talk about a peg to the yuan on the futures exchange in China, the Shanghai Exchange. Give us and our listeners today an idea of whether or not this sounds like a feasible reality.
Yes, I think this comment I would agree with and is appropriate. I think the idea of the Chinese is to eventually have a global currency, certainly with their trading partners. China is the largest trading partner with 124 different countries in the world, whereas the U.S. is only the largest trading partner with 74 countries in the world. So they have an interest basically to have one day renminbi. So with that comment, I kind of agree. Now, the question is, when will they implement it? And the question is, at what level? Because the Chinese economy is right now slowing down meaningfully. So they may first want to weaken their currency somewhat, not as much as the yen, but somewhat, and then introduce kind of a gold currency, could be.
Could you give folks an idea of the implications of such a currency, given the degree of lost purchasing power after several decades of currency devaluation, particularly now underway in the Eurozone? Sweden now has a negative benchmark lending rate. I believe Denmark has imposed currency controls. Several other nations are considering negative interest rates. This is somewhat unprecedented on a global scale. Give us an idea of a gold currency, how it might shift the economic landscape.
But I can tell you that over the last 20, 25 years, the economic landscape has shifted dramatically. Asia has grown very substantially, and the U.S. and Europe, in terms of GDP per capita, for the median household, in real terms, has declined. So there has been a huge shift in the economic balance from the West to the East and to emerging markets in general.
That's true. And we've seen this theme play out now for over a decade. However, I'm sure you've noticed that the equities market has remained robust now for going on 6 years following the credit crisis that was global in scope. Do you expect this theme to persist? Do you expect global capital to continue to flow in the United States and our domestic corporations to continue purchasing their own shares, boosting share prices?
I think it's a very good question. It is true that the U.S. market since 2011 has outperformed foreign markets meaningfully. But in the process, it has also become a very expensive market by historical standards. And my view is that if you go and talk around fund managers around the world, they will tell you the U.S. is the only game in town. I disagree. I think in 2015, emerging markets will outperform the U.S., by the way, as they have between the beginning of the year up to today.
Gold fund manager Egon von Graerts noted recently that hyperinflation has begun to take hold in some of the peripheral nations throughout Europe, and even somewhat in the United States. He is pointing to negative interest rates as supportive for asset prices, as we've already alluded to. There's really quite a debate still raging between the inflation camp and the deflation camp. Do you belong to either?
Well, inflation is a very complex subject. And I could talk to you for 1 hour what is inflation, what is not inflation. The fact is simply that over the last 10, 20, 30 years, the purchasing power of money has diminished very significantly. Just a few weeks ago, a Gauguin painting was sold for approximately $300 million. In the 70s, that kind of painting would have been worth maximum $5 to $10 million, maximum, maybe only $1 million. So, and real estate, same. If you have properties in Manhattan, Park Avenue, Madison, Fifth Avenue, it's gone up exponentially in the last 10, 20, 30 years. So what you have in dollars today is much less than what you had in dollars 30 years ago. So in that sense, there has already been a lot of inflation. Now, when it comes to goods, because we live in a globalized economy, you can buy today maybe some tools and some consumer goods cheaper than 20 years ago. A hammer or a drilling machine or whatever it is. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. But in general, I would say the typical household that hasn't had substantial assets is suffering. Household income for median, the typical household income in real terms is down. Wages in real terms are basically down. But the cost of living has gone up substantially. Partly also because of this brilliant idea of Obamacare. So all I'm saying is the household sector is suffering at the present time. That's why retail sales are not taking off. And whereas the employment numbers look better, high-paying jobs have been replaced by low-paying jobs. In the world, in the 70s, we had high consumer price inflation. Now we have extremely high asset price inflation, which I expect will also come down at some point and turn negative, including the stock market and the bond market.
Under that scenario, one would certainly be searching for safe havens, and there are at least 150 million stock market investors in just this nation alone, about a billion worldwide, primarily through corporate stock plans and 401ks and other government IRAs and things of that nature. So this would have a global and systemic impact.
Well, first of all, you just said that there may be a billion investors worldwide. The global population is 7 billion. When I'm not traveling, I stay in Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand. I would say 99 to 98% of the people, they wouldn't notice if the stock market crashed. It's not of their concerns, because they don't own any shares. Now, if the property market collapsed, that would be more of their concerns because they own, like in the U.S., properties on credit. The asset market inflation has benefited very few people in the world. The Fed doesn't realize that. Now, when you ask me about this question, I would say, yes, if asset markets decline, it will have an impact because, say, the asset markets go up, the stock brokers, Wall Street, the fund managers make money, then they go to restaurants and spend the money, and then the waiters get big tips, and so on. So it trickles down, for sure, but not to a meaningful extent, not to a meaningful extent. And my view is that if asset markets decline, actually, for the overall economy, it will be favorable. Now, coming to the corporate buybacks, corporations have a tendency to buy back their shares at high levels, not when the market is cheap. And just think of it logically. A corporation, they should invest in new businesses, new plant and equipment, but not buy back their shares. Basically, it's just to push up the share price. So the whole thing is a very artificial financial engineering that one day will end, in my opinion, I'm just saying my opinion, will end very badly. And as far as safe havens are concerned, you and I and your listeners, we don't know how the world will look like in 5 years' time. I would say we need, in absence of knowledge about the future, to diversify. So I would own some real estate. I would own some shares. I would own some bonds and cash. And I would own some precious metals. And this is what I do in a disciplined way.
Well, you certainly have some company there, particularly in that part of the world. China continues to import tons of gold through Hong Kong. We aren't certain of the stockpile. It's not regularly announced. They don't release a statement as some of the other countries in the world. And there's been some speculation lately. They may have accumulated much more than is widely accepted. In the event that at least a regional gold-based currency were to emerge, would you expect this to change the dynamics?
China increasingly trades directly with foreign countries, not in U.S. dollars, but in local currencies. I think that eventually China will have kind of a gold-backed currency, eventually. But it could be 5 years from now, it could be 10 years from now, or who knows. My view is that the U.S. dollars today, as a global currency, are doomed. Now, in this scenario, you should own some gold. I wouldn't say that you should put all your money in gold, although maybe some people would say, yes, if you're that bearish about the world and the U.S. dollar, you should put all your money in gold. But I'm not that courageous. I just diversify, as I told you. I would put about 25% of my money in gold. The point is, however, the following. The central banks around the world have engaged in money printing. And it's not at all a currency war. It is a coordinated effort by central banks that are run by some professors who've never worked a single day in their lives in the private sector to kind of bail out the system. Now, this bailout will, of course, fail. And when it fails, the question is, what will happen then? The central banks will, of course, blame people that own gold and assets and the rich people for their own mistakes. They will not say, we've been wrong. They will say, well, either we didn't do enough or because the rich people are hoarding money. So they'll go after the rich people and impose wealth taxes. and they'll go after the gold holders and say, okay, these are the evil people. They're holding gold. They're hoarding gold. And that's why the money doesn't flow into the system. So let's take it away from them. And so it's very important for owner of gold to know and think about where to hold the gold. The custody of the assets in future will be more important than the assets, in my view.
So then you would likely suggest that folks diversify globally their portfolio.
Yes. They should own some gold in physical form in Singapore or Hong Kong or in Asia, but not in the U.S. and most likely not in Switzerland and in Europe, because the Europeans are kind of briefcase carrying people of the U.S. Canada is to some extent the lacquer of the U.S. If the U.S. says, okay, they will not take your gold away. They will say, okay, today the gold price is $1,200 an ounce. We'll pay you $1,200 an ounce, but you have to surrender your gold. And then they go to Canada and they say to Canadian Central Bank, you have to do the same. I think they'll do the same. And then they go to the ECB and say, you have to do the same. And these people without any backbone, they'll do the same. But in Asia, I doubt they'll do the same. So this is just a thought of mine.
I certainly share your sentiments. Turn the discussion here back to the domestic economy. We have seen some slowing numbers recently. The U.S. GDP grew at a more sluggish pace, was released last week. And there is some talk from the new Fed chair that they may hold the benchmark lending rate lower than expected. In other words, not pull the trigger on higher rates as many people have been bracing for. Do you feel that the precious metals, at least in dollar terms, are being held hostage as folks sort of wait to see what the Fed's true intentions are on rates?
I think the Fed, if anything, in its current composition, and don't forget, whatever you may say about Mr. Greenspan and Bernanke, Greenspan started to increase the Fed fund rate in 2004, June 2004, from essentially 0% or 1% to 5.25% in 2006. This time around, the stock market bottomed out in March 2009, 666 on the S&P. Now we're more than 2,100. Now, economic recovery officially began in June 2009. So we're more than 5 years into an economic recovery, and we have zero interest rates. And the discussion is about maximum. I'm repeating, maximum, an interest rate increase of 0.25%. The whole thing is a complete charade. The Fed, in my view, is as clueless as anybody else is. They don't know. In my view, the Fed will not increase interest rates in 2015. So the whole stock market charade will continue to go on for a while, but increasingly, some people have second thoughts. They think, how does it all add up in the long run?
There's been considerable talk recently about the Eurozone, and a Greek exit has been on many investors' minds. Some folks are saying that this appears to be an unraveling, or leading to an unraveling, of the Euro region as a unified economic viable entity, whereas others say, well, the United States hasn't even addressed many of the issues that they are working through.
Well, my view is, this is more a political issue than an economic issue. The neocons in the U.S., as much as I dislike them, but the fact is they would like to control the whole world. And one stepping stone is to control Europe and not let anyone get into Europe. So, say, a Greek exit would open the door for Russia, which has already taken control of eastern Ukraine, and rightly so, because they were attacked by the U.S. and the neocons that financed the uprising in Ukraine and financed fascists in Ukraine. And they don't want Greece to leave the EU, because then the Russians could come in and help the Greeks or the Chinese. And so it will go with Italy and Spain and so forth. So in my view, the EU for now will stay in place. In time, it will probably weaken the economy of the EU. And maybe they'll even go bust.
Returning to your earlier thoughts about artwork, the comparison increase in prices, for instance, the piece you spoke of would have sold for maybe $10 million back in the 70s. And today, as much as $300 million, you know, it doesn't even take a pocket calculator to realize that's a 30-fold increase. That would seem to indicate that there might be a hidden world of price inflation that could erupt almost like a forest fire.
I would hold about 25% of my assets in precious metals. I don't know whether silver will go up more, or gold, or platinum, or that I don't know. But the fact is simply, I want to have some assets outside the banking sector. Because the banking sector is run by an academic mafia. They are the destroyers of the purchasing power of money. The professors at the Federal Reserve, they don't care about ordinary people. They are not even independent. They are ruled by someone that tells them, you do this, you do that. And that is largely the banking cartel. And I tell you, I feel very sorry for ordinary people. And I feel very sorry for young people, because America became a great nation in the 19th and 20th century, up to, say, the Vietnam War. In the 50s, the U.S. was way ahead of any other country in the whole world, way ahead. And there has been not an absolute, but a relative decline. This is a fact. The evidence is from all kinds of statistics, from real wages to, say, the relative importance of the U.S. within the global economy. Now, other countries have grown dramatically, but all I can say is I would hold some precious metals, because all the central banks in the world, it's not the currency war. This is an agreement among academics and professors that do not relate to the lives of ordinary people to print money. The baton is passed on from the U.S. to Japan and then to the EU and to the Bank of England and eventually to China and so forth, they all print money. And the purchasing power of money will continue to decline.
Your wisdom is certainly appreciated here. Your passion for the homme moyen, the bourgeois, you know, I think history has made it very clear that when the powers that be separate themselves in their ivory towers from the everyday individual, the end game is not pleasant, putting it euphemistically.
And I'd like to add one final comment. Mr. Greenspan, who I've known from the 1970s, was a highly intelligent person. Still is a highly intelligent person. But he admitted to me that the Fed is not independent. He said to me, I never said the Fed was independent. Number two, Mr. Bernanke was a perfect academic, but was basically clueless about the economy. Then he printed money, and the media, and of course the financial sector, called him a hero. Well, he led the U.S. into financial crisis in the first place. The office is called a hero for saving the system. Yeah. Was it worth saving? This is the question. Number three, Miss Yellen was, in the years 2004 to 2009 or 2010, she was the president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve, which was supervising California, Arizona, Nevada, and some other states. I'm not sure whether it was also Miami. But anyway, in her district, the real estate market collapsed the most. The most. She wouldn't see a bubble and is now the chair of the Federal Reserve. And I think that we will have more volatility this year.
We wish you continued success.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. My discussion last week regarding an article about Apple's plans to introduce a high-end version of its forthcoming Apple Watch in 18-karat gold has drawn doubt and speculation from the gold community about whether Apple can really pull this off and what the real impact will be to the global gold market if it does. Of course, if Apple did require 30% of the annual gold production to manufacture its high-end version of the Apple Watch, it would be a real game changer. Imagine the average person becoming fascinated, literally overnight, about the price of gold. People would be checking the price of the Apple Watch and the price of gold on a daily basis, because the price and value of the Apple Watch would surely fluctuate with the price of gold. The tradition that Ben Bernanke has attempted to pass gold off as, or the barbarous relic gold has been portrayed as, would evaporate overnight. And Apple would put gold into the mainstream consciousness, just like it has the iPad or the iPhone. The original article on the Apple Gold Watch indicated that the expected market is not, and I repeat, is not the United States. It is Asia and China. Yet we are filtering the reporting on the Apple Watch mostly from U.S. media. A headline in the local Las Vegas newspaper yesterday said, "Apple selling smartwatch to an uninterested public." I doubt that. I was in for a checkup yesterday, and my physician was wearing a smartwatch so he could read text messages on his wrist without looking at his iPhone. How many physicians will want a gold Apple Watch? Never mind the Asia or China market. As Chris Powell from Gata says, gold is in fact the secret knowledge of the financial universe, a secret desperately concealed by central banks. Apple's gold watch, in whatever quantity it catches on, represents a real threat to 40 years of paper money and anti-gold propaganda. If, and I say if, the Apple Gold Watch sells in quantities even remotely predicted, it will have a significant impact on the average person's perception and acceptance of gold. Apple may very well be introducing a John Galt moment into the paper fiat system, one that comes overnight and may be driven from the ground up. Don't ever forget that when Steve Jobs launched Apple in 1984, the controversial Super Bowl ad that he ran regarding 1984, and the individual's triumph over the collective. Don't remember it? Go to YouTube and put in Apple 1984 Super Bowl commercial and watch it. Compare that imagery with what has happened to our world as of late, especially in the financial system. And then ask yourself, if Apple succeeds and breaks gold into the mainstream consciousness, it will be the greatest gift and legacy that Steve Jobs could have ever left the world. Because it will have once again changed the world. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.